Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things that
Race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race, as we review the year 2022. The year 2022 was quite a year for progressive values, causes, and the issue of race continues to haunt our politics and social lives. The panelists of Let's Talk About Race deconstructed the year with previous episodes and news stories. Reflecting on 2022, the year Generation Z saved democracy.
One of the most remarkable stories out of the 2022 election, which is the turnout from Gen Z, that was not predicted by any of the models that reporters and analysts typically rely upon. It was undoubtedly incredibly important, but wasn't one that they saw coming. So I think important things to know about Gen Z: they really grew up with computers and understanding phones, social media, consuming a lot of information and being relatively savvy about it. They've had to, from a young age, be consuming all of that kind of thing. Another thing is that while it's kind of a mix as to whether or not Gen Z folks really remember 9/11, because some of them were born after 9/11 happened, they all do remember the 2008 recession. And that was not something that probably personally impacted them in terms of their financial prospects or getting into the job market like it had with, you know, their parents' generation or with millennials, who a lot of whom were graduating high school and college when that happened. But it was something that impacted their family finances, that they felt those effects as kids. And then I think, you know, one of the two other big influences on them we're going to see is school shootings and the pandemic. This is really a generation of the awareness of school shootings, of having to do school shooter drills in class, of understanding and being aware of from a young age, because that was such a prevalent issue for them, how politics plays into their daily life. That it wasn't an abstract thing, and it wasn't necessarily like, boy, it sure is an honor to be 18 and to get to vote in this election. Hope something good happens. It's highly consequential, and they understand what those consequences are. And I think you see that with the climate of school shootings and the lack of gun control in this country, as well as with the pandemic. You know, some of these freshly 18-year-old voters we saw in 2022 spent their last 2 years of high school online. They didn't have that full experience, or college students. You know, that's the kind of age that we're talking about, that these incredibly formative years were shaped, stymied, determined to be in this way that we don't even fully know how unhealthy it's been because of the actors on the political stage. And so, did Gen Z save democracy? I think save democracy is something that we have to do all the time. It's not something that is a one-and-done kind of deal, but there's definitely a new lease on life. There are new players in the field when we think about Gen Z who had been counted out. You know, there's a lot of generational war talk online between Gen Z and millennials, and all of sort of the micro trends and signals of those who are in the know and those who are out of it. But it is certainly a lease on the democratic experiment that Generation Z brought to the United States this year.
Our panelists knew during the summer of 2022 that hope was in the air. Althea, the most important event of 2022.
For the summer, for me, that is the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which was a historic investment in green energy. It invests in the IRS to be able to go after the big dog tax evaders, and it lowers prescription drug costs for Medicare. It does a lot of great things. It's a pared down version of the Build Back Better Act that Democrats failed to pass earlier this year, but it does a lot of really remarkable things, the kinds of things that the pessimists among us may have never thought possible, even though these are not, you know, as big of gains perhaps as what climate activists would have hoped for. But we are looking at climate tax breaks and rebates for the average person, energy efficiency funds for affordable housing. And through all of this, there's a lot of incentivization for companies, which really out there is a lot of ingenuity, invention, ready for this green future that has been waiting for government rebates and subsidies to incentivize it. And we're already seeing that in action. There's a few car companies that have now announced big new clean energy projects. And I also find it sort of exciting that you saw Democrats getting in the game. This was a deal with an important name that would be difficult to vote against, inflation reduction. And it was one where Joe Manchin, the longtime person to hold up Democratic activity in the Senate, was actually party to making something happen. Sure, Manchin and Sinema got some neoliberalism exceptions for the fossil fuel industry, which is not ideal. But again, we're not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good here. This is still really, really exciting stuff. And I think progressives, a lot of times we can end up chasing our own tail because the problems that we face are so big. But this is a major step forward. We're looking at a 40% reduction in emissions as a result of this act by 2030 compared to 2005. It's not exactly where we need to be, but it is a big step in that direction, a step that we weren't making, a step that had this deal not happened, would not have come through for folks. So I was incredibly heartened to see that happen and to see the political system churn out something that might actually help the average person and move our society forward towards evading climate disaster.
Mary Lee.
Yeah, most important story of summer 2022. Representation still matters. I think there's been some conversation that somehow we're post identity, representation, politics kind of thing. And I want to say we're not. It still matters. It's still important. We need to be able to support it. It's not the only strategy we should be pursuing or that we are interested in. And we should not leave it behind as some kind of tired old work that doesn't matter anymore. So my thought about representation matters, 5 Vietnamese candidates for public office throughout the state of Oregon. That has never happened in the history of Oregon. And I believe, according to the article, it's never happened in the nation. Each of these 5 candidates were applying for positions, running for positions that were at all levels of state and local government. All of them refugee or the children of immigrants. And once elected, would represent the largest representation of Vietnamese elected officials in the nation. That's important in and of itself. I also bring a perspective. I was one of the people who worked to found the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO, in 1996. And when the handful of local Asian American and indigenous Pacific Islander community members came together and started talking about what APANO might be, we never even had a dream that this might be the level of political representation. And since 1996 and through to today, the intentional work to build political power within Asian American, Indigenous Pacific Islander communities has been so diligently pursued throughout all of those years since 1996. And what you see today, through APANO's work, we now have a 501c4, which is a political action group. We issue endorsements for all of the races that we have determined and ballot measures that are meaningful potentially for Asian Pacific Islander communities and other communities of color. And we are now sought after as an endorsement from local public officials who see the value in understanding where the Asian American and Indigenous Pacific Islander communities stand politically. And we never had a dream of that, or it was a small dream. What I think is also phenomenal about this is that this is happening even in the midst of increased and unceasing, unrelenting violence against our people, our businesses, and our communities. We're still here. We're still strong, and we're still showing up in merely new and varied ways, like candidates.
Cecil.
Finally, that there is something being done in terms of student loan forgiveness. For many people who are elders who went to school when school costs were lower, who find it difficult to understand why many people have these huge college debts, we are learning that it is an industry that captures people who do not exactly know what they are signing up for, and the interest and how much it costs is overwhelming. So after a time in which the president hinted that he would do something about student debt, this summer, he finally came through with an executive order. Hopefully, this will lead to more action later on. But for me, that is one thing I would like to say is the good thing about the summer of 2022.
Professor Johnson.
For me, the most important event is the continued investigation of Donald Trump. And as much as I hate to even talk about him, the fact that they have discovered so many secret, top secret, and classified documents and empty folders that once contained classified documents, I believe that the legal outcome will finally see him maybe face some justice. Regardless of party affiliation, I don't think anyone can deny the malfeasance involved here to abscond with several hundred documents that are considered top secret, which means they could jeopardize our relationships with other countries as well as our allies. And some of them were found within personal items. So he had magazines and news clippings and top secret documents in a box. One of the most important events this summer, because it has continued to escalate. They have continued to make new discoveries. And this request for a third party reviewer, which is basically a effort on his part to delay and distract, isn't going to change the outcome.
Mia, what is the most important event that occurred in 2022?
For me, it was difficult. It was just a crazy news cycle, I think, this summer. I mean, from everything from the storms, inflation, the increased gun violence, the school violence. I live in Pennsylvania, and it's been a very contentious and heated sort of election season. It's just getting worse. You can't turn on the television in my market without every other ad is a negative ad. So the eyes of the country's on Pennsylvania. And our governor and Senate race ads have been literally running all summer long. So it's been a very interesting summer, not to mention we barely had a summer this year. We felt like we lived in South Carolina as opposed to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with all the thunderstorms, the storms, the flooding. So it's been pretty interesting. But when I took the time to think about it, what I felt was the most amazing spectacle of news this summer would have to be the House Select Committee January 6th investigation, the airing of the 7 episodes starting in June, ending in July, was amazing television. It was amazing and quite sad. There were moments that my family had to turn the TV off because we were going to get emotional. So the hearing was a series of 8 sessions. And what's interesting is that it was amazing to see how deep and wide the coordination with the Proud Boys, the GOP legislators who actually brought January 6 rioters in for a tour of the Capitol before that, looking at the text messages from Fox News, the various CEOs that were included in it, Justice Clarence Thomas's wife. It was absolutely insane. Really, the other side of that, you know, shining a light on the fraud and the deception and the coordination, the nefarious efforts of Trump and his inner circle, astonishingly has not affected the GOP support. And, you know, I live in a Trumpy neighborhood. It's almost like this House committee doesn't exist. People are continuing to double down on the big lie, not just in communities, but we're finding here that they're in the white evangelical church is really doubling down on the big lie and kind of mixing in some spiritual pseudo scripture into that. So it's just been a really interesting dynamic here in Western PA. It is good to see that shining a light on this, that there has been some legal backlash and continued convictions. Earlier, we were talking about the Cowboys for Trump county commissioner who's barred from holding office, a former NYPD police officer sentenced to 10 years for assaulting an officer at the Capitol. And we can't forget about Steve Bannon, who was held in contempt, but also may be convicted of stealing money in a build the wall fraud scheme.
That was Nia Gray, our faith reporter, discussing the most important event during the summer of 2022. Was it the summer of hope?
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
At Let's Talk About Race, our panelists wanted to share our best episodes of Let's Talk About Race during 2022. Reverend Cecil chose The Miseducation of the American Mind. Professor Johnson, Reading, Writing, and Book Burning. Our proud bureaucrat Mary Lee chose The Revolutionary Friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
The show that resonated with me is the show that we did in February of this year on reading, writing, and book burning. What brought me back to this show was, number one, that we have seen a continuation of books being banned across the United States in various school districts, and what seems to be a concerted effort to not teach true history. When we did the show, one of the pieces of information that came out was that many of these so-called forbidden books were not actually being requested to be removed by parents, but were being requested to be removed by conservative organizations with funding. This whole thing, I think, is a covert effort to cover up a desire to not teach history. That's one aspect of it. The other is the chipping away at the legal progress that we have made for our gay community. And we now have the potential of a presidential candidate coming from Florida, Ron DeSantis, who is very much a part of this movement. And I think that what we presented was solid information with a good discussion about the fact that some of the worries stemmed around making children uncomfortable, possibly exposing them to subjects or topics before they reached an age to fully understand it. But there was this also the complete disregard of children of color, Black, brown, yellow, red, who are also made uncomfortable at school and have been for years. So I thought it was a good discussion and a very worthwhile show. And this is going to become even more relevant because of the upcoming presidential run or race. I think it'll be one of the topics, one of the important topics in that race.
I think it is something more nefarious, as you asked. John Legend tweeted recently, "Aren't Black parents parents also? Let our history be taught." And this is part of a long history of seeking to obliterate or ignore the history of the American people that is different from the popular, and I would say not accurate, portrayal of the establishment of the American Republic. It is crucial for concerned people to stand up and say that all history is important and that we need to hear the voices and the stories. And if we are uncomfortable, so let it be. I think we should ask, what about the comfort level of Indigenous people when you forget about their history? What about how uncomfortable Chinese Americans, descendants of people who were not welcome, how do they feel? What about the uncomfortableness of Latino and Latina citizens who are ignored in much of our history? I think it is part of an ongoing effort not only to restrict the accurate portrayal and teaching of history, but a way in which to continue to control the American electorate and to have a way in which power remains in the hands of a few.
Mary Lee, what are your thoughts?
There's part of me that almost wants to laugh at this idea of children cannot be made to feel uncomfortable, guilty. Let's be absolutely clear. Our children, as Reverend Prescott says, have always been absolutely made to feel uncomfortable, guilty, and worse in the public education system. And there was no problem with that. In fact, it was understood that that was the way it was. There was a righteousness about this. And for now, a small number of predominantly white families and parents to somehow be overly concerned about the uncomfortable nature, the guilty nature that their children might potentially be exposed to by the telling of truth about our history is laughable in many ways if it wasn't so dangerous and horrific. I think this is absolutely connected to many other repressive strategies. And I think it drives back to the fear of the mythological end of the world as we know it, AKA 2044, 2045, when the minority majority will be the case in the U.S. I think a lot of the repression and the actions of the right have been driven by the fear of this, you know, future horror that is coming to eat up our country and eat up ourselves. There's a couple of things that are, again, erroneous about it. I think the inability for people to actually tell the truth about things is shocking, right? We've had a lot of conversations about this. We are already minority-majority in many places around the country. Particularly, the first place we're going to see and understand this is with our children and our schools. Our population, as you go younger, is getting more brown, more people of color, more Black, more Indigenous. And that means that things need to and should have been and are changing. Those who have been in power, those who have accepted power as their entitled right, are understandably nervous and afraid. The danger is where they decide that they have to take some action. The focus under the guise of parental control, right? We're simply wanting to make parents be able to make decisions for their children is clear and strategic. You know, in many schools and districts where children of color are the majority in the school, the teachers are predominantly white and the agitators are predominantly white parents. And they are the ones that districts and school boards are being pandered to. You also have to tie in the very clear strategy that I think was practiced. It died down a little bit and it's come right back up to the forefront of the stage by the right and the religious right working to get themselves elected to these quote unquote lower elected positions, particularly school boards, utility districts, you know, in order to try to start influencing from a very grassroots bottom up place of becoming elected and thus being able to make the policies that we are going to have to deal with now and in the future. And there are many people who have talked about this as part of a strategy where we're going to look at restricting voting rights to manipulate power and disenfranchise whole buckets of our community, whole pieces of our community today. And we're going to indoctrinate and continue to teach self-hatred and a supremacy culture of white people and white supremacy culture to our own children that will infect them and their selves coming into the future.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, the year 2022 in review.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
There were so many great programs, but one that caught my attention and one which I listened to more than once was The Miseducation of the American Mind, which was aired in May of 2022. And immediately, a couple of things grabbed my attention when I was looking over up programs this year was the title. Immediately, I thought of The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson, which was a tome written in the early 1930s, which talked about how the education system created for Black Americans was largely prompted by philanthropy and wasn't interested in educating Blacks to have the knowledge and the skills to take on the task necessary to form a great society and to participate more fully. And I also thought of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, the neo-soul album by Lauryn Hill in 1998, in which she talked about turmoil in her former groups and how she managed to have a new way of viewing the world. So I thought of those two books and music because The Miseducation of the American Mind was a program which focused on how Americans are not receiving accurate information. It talked about the phenomenon of conspiracy theories and how those things continue to have a grasp on the American psyche. What was interesting about this program also were that the different panelists voiced various opinions and ideas about how to address those issues, and ways to overcome it. And finally, that show talked about media and social tools that are used today. And our news director, Althea, gave a very great lesson on how social media worked. And so that program was interesting to me, not only because of the topic, but also in ways in which the panelists engage with one another, and also the educational aspect that panelists offer to all of us. So programs such as this give me some hope that the miseducation of the American mind may not be the last thing that happens, and that education, accurate education, is possible.
Today we're going to talk about the miseducation of the American mind. Conspiracy theories are not new. They've been around since the start of our republic. And we've all heard the word QAnon, whether we've been on social media or on the news. But we're going to discuss today, why is QAnon so dangerous? How has the fake news and the increase of Americans getting one source news from social media contribute to this misinformation? And then how the dissemination of religious disinformation has caused a fracture in the American Christian church. We're going to start with QAnon. At its heart, QAnon is a wide-ranging, completely unfounded theory that says that President Trump is waging war, or secret war, against elite, Satan-worshipping pedophiles in government, business, and the media. So I'll start with Althea Billings. Conspiracy theories are not new. So why is QAnon so dangerous?
QAnon has grown in its power because in some ways it is the conspiracy theory that sort of vacuums up every other conspiracy theory around. And at its core, as you mentioned, it repackages anti-Semitic tropes that date back even before the Nazis. Feelings about, or sentiments, I should say, about Jewish people related to, and stereotypes related to banking, related to controlling government and things like that, that are not based in any sort of fact. And what QAnon does is it, everything has an explanation, which means that none of it can ever be disproven. And because it sort of loops in all these different conspiracy theories, it makes it so there's a whole bunch of different avenues for people to find their way to it through perhaps more innocuous means. For example, there was a hashtag on Twitter last year called #SaveTheChildren, and there were rallies happening. People were gathering on street corners with signs saying "Save the Children," which feels very innocuous. The idea of child trafficking, child sex trafficking, that's troubling at a very base level for, I think, most everyone. And it seems innocuous. It seems like, of course, that would be something that I would support. But it is, in fact, a backdoor into the belief that world governments are, in fact, controlled by a cabal of Satan worshipers and pedophiles. And those are the children that need saving. QAnon has obviously become incredibly powerful, and it is not easily disproven. But it is rooted in discontent, fear, all of these different things that have been present in history at any given time, right? You can also circle back to, you know, Salem witch trial. Some people want to cite in this conversation that there are instances where collective action defies logic. But one thing I wanted to mention is that one thing that I find interesting about QAnon believers and how widespread it's become is that there is a certain amount of it that is rooted in, I guess you could say, a real sentiment of discontent, of feeling that, you know, the elite, the rich, the ruling class have become more empowered, and that average people, workers, are disempowered as a result. And there's data to say that that's true. But instead of seeing those solutions as, hey, let's empower unions, let's raise the minimum wage, let's work for workers, let's not give tax breaks to the rich, instead, the conspiracy swings far in the other direction and instead hands all the power to a seriously exploitative fraudster, Donald Trump.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
One of my favorite shows every year is the Happy Birthday Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama. And I want to call out the Blue Scholar song, Yuri, that line of when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama. I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama. And that relationship for me, I hold up in a number of ways because it speaks to two proud individuals not rejecting their communities, not rejecting their cultures, not rejecting the real differences and challenges between them. And still coming together in pursuit of the greater good, in pursuit of the common good, in pursuit of an understanding about our collective work and responsibility.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas. When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama.
On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we are diverting from our regular programming to celebrate the May 19th birthdays of Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama. On paper, Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X made an unexpected pair. A Japanese-American mother of six and a Muslim minister, black nationalist, and human rights activist. Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama had a revolutionary friendship that was interrupted by Malcolm X's assassination in 1965. And at the assassination of Malcolm X, Yuri was there. May 19th is the birthday of both Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X. As we celebrate their birthdays, Yuri and Malcolm's revolutionary friendship highlighted the multiracial cooperation of the civil rights movement and the broader fight against racial injustice around the world. With the music of Blues Scholars, Grassroots News invites our listeners to celebrate the revolutionary friendship of Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X on their birthdays, May 19th.
People told us, Malcolm, not going to go to your house. He doesn't know you, and it's dangerous for him right now. What made you think that he might come? Well, I said, well, it's true, I'm not sure. I wrote to him. I did not hear from him, but his office called and said they would do whatever they could that he might come. And he did. And our place was jam-packed. Well, we lived in a housing project in Harlem. And I wasn't sure he was going to come, so I didn't want to advertise it too much and have people come, and then they'll wonder what happened and he didn't come. But a lot of people showed. Our house was jam-packed, and Malcolm did come, and we were all so surprised and just so tickled. People were really more amazed that he would take the chance of coming to a strange home of people he didn't even know anything about, when there were so many rumors that something might happen to Malcolm. And when he did come, of course, the people were just so excited. Everybody wanted to shake his hand. They didn't know if he would shake the hands of white people or what. But Malcolm just surprised everyone. He was so warm to everyone, no matter what color. And people were just astounded that Malcolm has that wonderful way He's so down to earth.
What brought me to her is that photograph in Life magazine. She is cradling the head of Malcolm X right after he's assassinated. She witnessed his assassination.
I seen a picture up in Life magazine. You were sitting in front seat for Malcolm's last speech. Saw the first man with the shotgun. Two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if he never died, would he know that he existed? Or would he been the leader that we always seem to miss? Now there's no turning back, whatever happens and I miss. You remind me that it's more than just a martyr in a myth. You could have said it quits many times ever since. And you find there will always be a reason for the fist. The last one to hold him could have been somebody else. You still be remembered for the people that you helped. They said it keep trying, but never losing hope. Revolutionaries die, but the revolution don't, and it won't. And I put that on my mama, cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Koshiyama.
Two people did a diversion. One guy got up and said, "Get your hands out of my pocket." And they started fighting, the two. And when that fighting was going on, everybody was looking at them. They were just almost across from where we were sitting. But while we're all watching these two, the three people up front got up with shotguns and they hit Malcolm quite a few times. I mean, you could imagine, here is Malcolm, one of the most beloved people by the people that were there for him in Harlem. And seeing him get shot and die, of course, what happened was the cops were smart. They didn't, usually they're everywhere, but they didn't come into that hall that day. They wanted something to happen, and it did. Malcolm was killed, and it was such a big news that I know when I left the Audubon Hall and I had to go to work at a restaurant, I didn't know whether I should go or not. But even the subways, they had a message through the subway system that Malcolm X was shot. I just want to read something about that someone wrote, which I thought was beautiful, about Malcolm. Malcolm was not just a black man. He was the black experience. He went through everything that the poorest blacks had gone through. He was baptized into blackness and repudiated his slave name and took on the X, the unknown, the potential of what could be, the reality of what he became. So I'm glad you asked the one question on Malcolm. Thank you.
Yuri Koshiyama died June 1st, 2014. Malcolm X was assassinated February 21st, 1965. They were both born May 19th. Happy birthday, Malcolm. Happy birthday, Yuri.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Our news director, Althea Billings, shares with us the most important story of 2022.
The most important story of 2022 was the Supreme Court wreaking havoc on American institutions. Of course, most notably is the Dobbs decision that overturned the right to an abortion. That's had wide-ranging effects, including influencing the 2022 election and requiring significant grassroots efforts across the country to ensure that people can access reproductive health care. But that's not the only thing that the Supreme Court either decided on or heard cases about this year. And I think it's important to highlight just the amount of critical issues that are at the Supreme Court level at this moment and the kind of impact that those decisions can have. Most recently, the Supreme Court declined to protect Trump's tax returns from the House Ways and Means Committee. That we will see an impact of. How many years has it been talking about Trump's tax returns? Maybe since 2015. Finally, the Supreme Court says, no, we're not protecting those. In this fall term, when they've been hearing cases, there's a particularly consequential one dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. And the way things are going, it looks like the Supreme Court may overturn ICWA and end up challenging hundreds of years of tribal sovereignty law. And something that's notable about this story is that it's a complex section of, you know, federal law and one that most justices are not well versed in. And they admit that in testimony. And yet this could have sweeping effects on a very important child welfare law that was passed in the 70s to combat this incredibly racist history of white people trying to assimilate Native Americans through residential schools, through hostile adoptions, essentially. That is one that I am certainly watching in the new year. Other things from the Supreme Court this year, they cut the EPA's ability to regulate the energy sector. That wasn't great. The constitutional right to pray in public schools. That one didn't even really make headlines, but that also changes years and years of precedent. They said that limiting concealed carry of guns in New York State actually violates the Second Amendment. That's a pretty big blow to people trying to regulate gun violence in this country. The separation of church and state, one of the big ones. They ruled that state tuition can go to religious schools, and in fact, it is a violation if it doesn't. They will also offer a rule on affirmative action in colleges next year, and with the conservative bloc on the court, there's a strong suspicion on the way that they're going to rule on that. It is likely that they will strike it down and make it unconstitutional. So I think something to reflect on for 2022 is how undemocratic, significantly consequential and undemocratic the Supreme Court is. And even in cases where they admit that they are not as knowledgeable as perhaps they ought to be for the wide-ranging and sweeping effects that their decisions can have. I think it's something that folks need to pay attention to. We've highlighted it on this show before, that especially for folks who are, you know, liberal or progressive or further on the left, for a lot of the 20th century, the Supreme Court was a venue for moving social change forward, for extending rights, for protecting people that Congress couldn't get it done. So that was the venue to do it. But the same undemocratic institution cuts the other way, and conservatives have been working for years to control the federal courts because of these kinds of decisions, because of the end-all be-all type of impunity that the Supreme Court has. And it's an important institution, but it's not one that is well-founded in terms of its rules, in terms of its ethics, in terms of how its justices have to conduct themselves, when they have to recuse themselves. All of this kind of stuff, I think, is worth thinking about, is worth noticing. And though, of course, the Dobbs decision was one that had a really big impact, and I think a lot of people are aware of, the Supreme Court made a lot of big moves this year, and I think there's more to come. And that's why it's my most important story of the year.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Listening to the news is experiencing one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we created a new segment to inspire. This segment is entitled, Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
Hope is a thing with feathers means that you have something and it rises. It takes off. And for me, the hope that flies, that rises, is the hope that we are able to make concrete changes in our society and in the world. There is so much that is terrible about the world, from climate change to the way governments are failing to meet the needs of people, the way in which families are struggling to find affordable housing and get good schooling. But the hope is that we know that things do not have to remain the same, and that if we just look at our ancestors and how they met the challenges they encountered and how they were able to rise above, that we too, in this generation, can meet the challenges we face and rise up. So my hope is that the people will continue to rise up and continue to press for change that create a better world for all.
And finally, we end 2022 with a speech from Michigan State Senator Mallory McMorrow.
I didn't expect to wake up yesterday to the news that the senator from the 22nd district had overnight accused me by name of grooming and sexualizing children in an email fundraising for herself. So I sat on it for a while wondering why me. And then I realized, because I am the biggest threat to your hollow, hateful scheme. Because you can't claim that you are targeting marginalized kids in the name of, quote, parental rights if another parent is standing up to say no. So then what? Then you dehumanize and marginalize me. You say that I'm one of them. You say she's a groomer. She supports pedophilia. She wants children to believe that they were responsible for slavery and to feel bad about themselves because they're white. Well, here's a little bit of background about who I really am. Growing up, my family was very active in our church. I sang in the choir. My mom taught CCD. One day, our priest called a meeting with my mom and told her that she was not living up to the church's expectations and that she was disappointing. My mom asked why. Among other reasons, she was told it was because she was divorced and because the priest didn't see her at Mass every Sunday. So where was my mom on Sundays? She was at the soup kitchen with me. My mom taught me at a very young age that Christianity and faith was about being part of a community, about recognizing our privilege and blessings and doing what we can to be of service to others, especially people who are marginalized, targeted, and who had less. Often unfairly. I learned that service was far more important than performative nonsense like being seen in the same pew every Sunday or writing Christian in your Twitter bio and using that as a shield to target and marginalize already marginalized people. I also stand on the shoulders of people like Father Ted Hesburgh, the longtime president of the University of Notre Dame, who was active in the civil rights movement, who recognized his power and privilege as a white man, a faith leader, and the head of an influential and well-respected institution, and who saw black people in this country being targeted and discriminated against and beaten, and reached out to lock arms with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he was alive, when it was unpopular and risky, and marching alongside them to say, we've got you, to offer protection and service and allyship to try to right the wrongs and fix injustice in the world. So who am I? I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom who knows that the very notion that learning about slavery or redlining or systemic racism somehow means that children are being taught to feel bad or hate themselves because they are white is absolute nonsense. No child alive today is responsible for slavery. No one in this room is responsible for slavery. But each and every single one of us bears responsibility for writing the next chapter of history. Each and every single one of us decides what happens next and how we respond to history and the world around us. We are not responsible for the past. We also cannot change the past. We can't pretend that it didn't happen or deny people their very right to exist. I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom. I want my daughter to know that she is loved, supported, and seen for whoever she becomes. I want her to be curious, empathetic, and kind. People who are different are not the reason that our roads are in bad shape after decades of disinvestment, or that healthcare costs are too high, or that teachers are leaving the profession. I want every child in this state to feel seen, heard, and supported, not marginalized and targeted because they are not straight, white, and Christian. We cannot let hateful people tell you otherwise to scapegoat and deflect from the fact that they are not doing anything to fix the real issues that impact people's lives. And I know that hate will only win if people like me stand by and let it happen. So I want to be very clear right now. Call me whatever you want. I hope you brought in a few dollars. I hope it made you sleep good last night. I know who I am. I know what faith and service means and what it calls for in this moment. We will not let hate win.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race. Thank you for listening.